Kentucky hills of Tennessee, where the mockingbird is singing high up in the laurel tree. Let the Alabama moon shine.
Hello, and welcome to the Daily Music Break podcast. The Daily Music Break, which offers music across all eras and genres, can be found at www.dailymusicbreak.com. Visit for good music and free email newsletters. Today we have the pleasure of speaking with Andy Stein. It's impossible to mention all the notable people he has played with. The list is just too long. And I'll include a full bio in the post. Suffice it to say that somebody whose profile includes Commander Cody and His Lost Planet, Ammon, Plácido Domingo, Eric Clapton, Itzhak Perlman, Wynton Marsalis, the Pizzarellis, Michael Jackson, and Paul McCartney, to name just a few, is an important musician. He also, no doubt, is a man with a lot of interesting stories. I appreciate him taking time out today. Hello, Andy, and thanks again for spending some time with us.
It's my pleasure.
Before we get started, and it was a rather long intro, can you tell the folks where they can find Andy Stein Music?
Well, I have a website, andysteinmusic.com. That's andysteinmusic.com.
Okay, and all the info is there, and all the music. That's
yeah,
great.
I have to say the it's not as up to date as I would like it to be, but we'll talk about different things that I'm planning to put on there that I haven't yet.
Okay.
Mostly some of the sheet music or classical music that I've written. Mm-hmm. It's not at least you can contact me. It's there, you know.
Okay. And once you get it updated, let me know and I'll put a note at the website.
All right.
Andy, you've excelled both as a saxophonist and as a violinist. That's rare. I'm not sure I've heard of somebody who's excelled at both at the professional level in two completely different instrumental families. Can you describe how that's possible for you?
How it's possible for me? Unfortunately, I have to admit that the violin is really my main instrument.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the fact that I practice it more consistently. I am in New York where there are all these doublers that are expected to play great saxophone, clarinet, and flute.
Right.
And some bassoon and oboe and stuff. And yes, they all blow and they all require diaphragms and stuff like that, but
right.
They are really different. And when you move from saxophone to clarinet and back and forth, you have to be careful not to use a saxophone embouchure on the clarinet, just for an example, you know.
Right.
But
right.
As far as, and I play really, really, really bad clarinet, but enough, I'm not out of tune, so at least in a big group. I play fourth clarinet in the band, you know, for 8 bars. It's not going to be the bad apple anyway. But between the two instruments, I mean, I started out as a violinist as a kid, as so many people do.
Right.
And then in the summers, I got into folk music. I went to this summer camp that was run by Pete Seeger's brother, John Seeger.
Oh, really?
And there was a lot, I left my fiddle at home every summer and I went up to this camp and I played guitars and banjos and mandolins and, you know, sang folky stuff and then got into bluegrass and old time music. So, when I was about 12 or so, I started bringing my fiddle and started getting into country music on the fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
But, that's when I, those are the chops I had pretty much 8 years later when I joined Commander Cody.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Michigan and I was a fiddle player. I was a violin major in music school. So, I mean, for instance, after we all moved from Ann Arbor to California, we came back on tour and played and opened for the Byrds at Hill Auditorium in Ann Arbor, and which seats like 3,000 people or something. And then the next day, I went up to the music school and played my senior recital for Prokofiev and Schoenberg and Bach and Crowley.
That's amazing. You're getting a little ahead of us now. We should tell the people that you were one of the founding members of Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen. So you had a double life going on there, so to speak.
Yeah, in those days I was also playing jazz bass in a little trio we had with a piano and drums, and I played bass in the orchestra actually, classical bass. Go ahead.
No, I'm just going to ask, is there a fundamental difference, and this we are skipping around in the list of questions I sent you, but when you play rock, jazz, classical music, is there a fundamental difference between them, or is it all kind of notes on paper kind of thing? Do you have to think differently, just dress differently?
Maybe? Right. Most of the stuff that we're talking about is not on paper. Certainly rock and roll. Jazz is partially on paper. But the paper is really just a guide, you know. It's unfortunate that music is written that way. It's almost, I mean, reading in general is, you know, part of your brain takes these details, you know, one side of the brain, and then it puts it together and it says, oh, is that what you mean? Why didn't you say so? You know, right. That's what, you know, when you first learn the letters of a word and you read it, and then it takes a whole other side of the brain to put them together and say, oh, it's that word that I already know.
Right.
You know, and music is that way, too, in terms of reading on the page.
Right.
It's really a roundabout way of expressing what music is all about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about the written stuff. But in terms of the different approaches to the different music, you know, Duke Ellington is famous for saying there's only two kinds of music, good music and bad music.
Right.
You know.
And he played the good kind, that's for sure.
I try.
Mm-hmm. It says this in your bio towards the end at your website. Stein attributes a large part of his success in many different genres to his chamber music background. Why is chamber music important in this equation?
Well, when you grow up and you play music, you first learn to listen to yourself and try and catch whatever imperfections are going on sooner than anybody else catches it. For instance, when they slowed down a recording of Yasha Heifetz on the violin, the greatest violinist of the 20th century, they found out that he plays out of tune just like everybody else. It's just he fixes it quicker than anybody else, so nobody ever hears it. You know,
right.
So, so when you grow up, you learn to listen to yourself. But when you start, when you start playing chamber music, the whole idea is listening to everybody else while you are playing your part. And the concept of that, of listening to others while you play, is fundamental to playing good music with other people.
For the uninitiated, such as myself, how is listening to other people in chamber music different than in another form of music? Is it
it's not, which is why I could carry that skill over to other forms of music.
Mm-hmm. Chamber music's more exacting in that sense? You have to do it quicker?
Well, I wouldn't... you certainly... let's see, explain. In chamber music, say you are playing second violin in a string quartet, which is first violin, second violin, viola, and cello. The second violin and the viola are called the inner voices. They're, you know, they're not the bottom, the cello, and they're not the top, the first violin. Normally, you know, as a general rule, which of course has exceptions. In any case, many times, if the second violin and the viola are there in the middle, sort of rounding out a chord, they have to tune it to the cello that has the bass note with the overtones, and you want to kind of get your music, get your notes to buzz in the right way to resonate with the lower note. That's fundamental intonation stuff. And that is used in a saxophone section or in a woodwind section in an orchestra. You have to tune to the second bassoon or to the baritone sax. The intonation goes from the bottom up. But for instance, in a sax section and a string quartet, if there's a block voicing where everybody sort of is playing together like a chorale or something, in terms of how long or short or how loud or soft every note play goes, if the first violinist does a swell and then a diminuendo, you need to match that. And that's a rule in a big band. The simple rule is, I mean, when you have three trumpets, three trombones, and four saxes or whatever, whoever is the loudest instrument is the person that you have to listen to and try and match. So when the saxes are playing with the brass, you listen to the first trumpet. When the saxes are playing something different than the brass, then you listen to the first alto sax, the lead alto.
Oh, boy.
So, and when you're in a string quartet, you listen to everybody to try and get a homogeneous approach to the music.
Doesn't sound like you can have many bad days when you're doing this stuff. You really have to be on top of your game. It sounds very, I guess it comes more intuitively when you have skills in those directions and you study it for a long time, but it sounds absolutely, it sounds very difficult is what it sounds like.
Well, it's not. It's similar to some people like me for the last 5 minutes. Just talk, and don't listen to other people in a conversation.
Well, that part I'm good at.
And so, and other people are much more, or other situations are more back and forth, where you actually talk and listen almost at the same time.
Right.
It's just a mindset, that's all.
Talk about Commander Cody for a second. That band, Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen, seem to have a special place in the hearts of many rock and roll fans, maybe about my age in their mid-50s. What do you attribute that band's lasting popularity to? I'm sure you get asked about them all the time, having been a founding member. What do you attribute that to, Andy?
Well, you know, I didn't complete one other sentence. You asked me about the two instruments, and I should do that background thing. You can splice it in or whatever. But I didn't start the saxophone until after I joined Commander Cody. And this sort of has to do with your current question also. Commander Cody was a eclectic, roots-oriented band.
Right.
And we played many different genres of music as differently as we could, but we still, of course, sounded like us. You can never really completely camouflage as somebody else. So we played gospel music. We played Staple Singer's tune. We played Joe Tex, a soul singer from Nashville, a black, you know, a wonderful R&B guy, and we played Hank Williams, we played George Jones, we played country music. We played rockabilly, Carl Perkins, Elvis. We played Little Richard. We played just all sorts of stuff. And then, you know, the popularity has to do with the niche of, I guess, our most well-known sort of cult songs or something would be I'm Lost in the Ozone.
Right.
You know, one drink of wine, one drink of gin, and I'm lost in the ozone again.
Right.
So you can understand how that would fill a niche in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
In terms of an anthem. Then there was another song similar, which is called I'm Down to Seeds and Stems Again Blues. And,
right.
And you know, the finance company came today, took away my dog or whatever, and, you know, everything's horrible. And on top of that, I'm down to seeds and stems again, too. So those two songs could generally describe the cult following that we had. And I would just say that what made it special was that we really did listen to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And three of our musicians, the lead singer, Billy C. Farlow, and the bass and drums, Lance Dickerson. I'm sorry, the bass is Bruce Barlow and Lance Dickerson on drums. They all came from a blues background.
Right.
And we had that Chicago blues approach, which is, along with Dixieland, I would say, are the two most important American, you know, vernacular music that uses what I could call counterpoint, where, in other words, two people are playing pretty freely together. They are playing pretty freely. Each one has something to say, but it magically fits together.
Right.
And that's a characteristic, certainly of Dixieland, where you have the clarinet and the trumpet and the trombone and the front line all kind of blowing.
Right.
In a secretly organized way, but you hear everybody just kind of wailing. And
right.
Yet it sounds good because they are listening to each other while they're wailing. And you have that same thing in Chicago blues. And that's I think that's really important part of Commander Cody.
It's organized chaos is what it sounds like.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And most other bands, things were less chaotic,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that organized chaos, excuse me, I'm just thinking out loud here, but that kind of is a wonderful way to express the ideas that I talked about in those songs.
Right.
Well,
and there also seems to be a theme from what you were talking about with the classical music and the chamber music, is the need to listen to the other instruments and not be lost in your own little ozone, to really be listening as much as playing.
I had the opportunity to play in an amateur orchestra. We played the Schubert Unfinished Symphony, and I played the bass trombone part in this orchestra. Mm-hmm. I played the bass trombone part on the Barry sax, okay? We just had to cover it somehow. But it was an eye-opening experience for me because when you're in the back row of an orchestra like that and you come in and play as loud as you can, because that's what your job is at that one point, you can't hear anybody else. You
mm-hmm.
cannot apply the skills that we have just talked about. They don't work because
it must be scary.
You're way back there and you can't hear the people in front of you, certainly when you're playing so loud yourself.
Right.
So all you can do is follow the conductor and try and play as in tune as you can. If you're the bass trombone like I was, then you're the guy that lays down the intonation that everybody else has to match because it goes from the bottom up.
And how much of that are you playing without hearing the other folks?
Well, I mean, it varies, but the first big chord that the brass come in the Unfinished Symphony, mm-hmm. kind of notorious. It's supposed to be a major, just an obnoxious interruption,
mm-hmm.
but it's still got to be in tune. But it opened my eyes to, because I've written a fair amount of orchestra music, and as a string player, I sometimes ask the second violins, could you please listen to, you know, the second bassoon who's doing something that really should match with you. Now I understand, to some people, they would hear that and they say, you got to be kidding. You want me to actually listen to that guy across, you know, 100 feet away? Not 100, 50 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
While I'm playing? I can't do that. My job is to follow the stick. I follow the conductor and I play what's written on the page, and I play in tune, I play it right. And if you don't like that, you know, get somebody else, you know. So that's a hierarchical way of playing, and it's the way orchestras work as opposed to chamber music. And so I realize there's a lot of music being made where those skills are not really expected.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an eye-opener for me, because even string players generally in an orchestra are able to listen to others more than, because they're in the front and they don't play as loud. Their instruments just aren't as loud individually.
Mm-hmm. I always wanted to ask a question to someone who wrote music. Do you come up with a harmony and a melody first and then create the kind of the edifice around it? I mean, what is the process like? And it must be different for different folks, but do you come up with a nice melody and then create the whole work around it? Or is there a different process involved?
Interesting question. I do more arranging than I do composing, but I do a fair amount of composing. I wrote an opera with Garrison Keillor. My job started there. He likes to write parody lyrics to existing Warhorse, opera arias, you know, well known.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. We should inject here that you're in the Lake Wobegon Orchestra. What's the name?
Not anymore. But for 22 years, I was the regular guy on a regular. Participant of the live broadcasts of Prairie Home Companion with Garrison Keillor. That position kind of ended after 22 years, about 3 years ago. And that's so I'm not doing it really much anymore. You hear me on repeats in the summertime when they take off.
And I didn't mean to interrupt what you were saying, though, Andy. So
it's okay. So at one point, Garrison had this, had promised the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra that he was going to write an opera for them. And so obviously he's a words guy, not a music guy. But as I said, he'd written, he has a hobby of writing parody lyrics to opera war horses, to famous arias from operas. And so he hired me as an arranger to make that work, and he was going to write a whole opera like that. Mm-hmm. But after about a third of the material was done, we ran out of opera war horses, and we still had a plot to finish and another hour and a half of music and, you know, stuff to do. So he said, here are the lyrics. Find me an aria that would fit this. And I said, you got to be kidding. So I started writing in the style of various composers for the opera. Now, this is all to answer your question a little bit. I had the first step is to figure out what is needed, you know. I see these words, and it sounds like something the Countess would sing in Mozart's Figaro. in Mozart's opera, Marriage of Figaro. And so I figure I'm going to take these words and write something that sounds like Mozart. So that's what I did. And other times, there's other situations. We had a singer who was had a wonderful voice, the mezzo-soprano, but she had a hard time learning material. And we had I had to write something for her that at the last minute we had to fix something, and I had to write another little aria for her. And I decided I would write it as stepwise as possible, so that it would be easy to learn very quickly. Okay, so that was fairly easy to listen, to learn, and it was a waltz, and it it fit the bill. So in terms of how you start writing it, for me, I don't like have this this melody in my head that I need to find a place to put it. I tend to be more inspired by need.
Mm-hmm.
I try to figure out what is necessary.
That makes perfect sense. I've always been fascinated by how. So I have absolutely no musical talent. How people come up with melodies is just, you know, that very thing amazes me, that people can come up with these beautiful melodies. I never really got it.
Right. Well, that's another thing. I like to imitate other composers.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry for the siren there.
Yes.
I, you know, do have a strong classical background, and I have been able to sort of fake other composers, and I wrote a nice Bach fugue that I am happy with, and I've written Mozart for that opera, I've written Puccini for that opera, etc. And so at this point I'm trying to write Brahms, and I think it's the ultimate challenge in terms of finding. He came up with these beautiful melodies, these beautiful themes that were almost how should I say, they're almost anthems, or they're almost archetypical melodies, but they have a twist. And Brahms was one of the most eclectic. People think of Brahms as just the guy that wrote the Brahms Lullaby and stuff like that. But in fact, he wrote with many different influences. He went all the way back 100 years to Bach. And he went back. Of course, he was influenced by Beethoven. And, you know, they talk about the three B's. Well, this is the third of the B's, you know. So I'm interested in the challenges of writing a melody in that style. And melody is a tricky thing.
I can certainly imagine. This is a nice way to bring it full circle. One of the questions I planned to ask you at the beginning, and I didn't, but I'll ask you now because I think it fits in, is who was Lillian Fuchs, and what impact did she have on your development?
Okay, she was my aunt. And she was a very famous violist. She was, in fact, anybody who goes to a conservatory and studies the viola, chances are they study at least one of her books. She has a book of characteristic studies and another one of caprices, a set of caprices. And there's other music that she's written. But she taught at Juilliard and at the Manhattan School of Music for about 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And was the main teacher for many, many successful musicians. She also, besides teaching the viola, she coached chamber music extensively. So that everybody from Pinky Zukerman on down... had her as a chamber music coach.
You guys call him Pinky?
Yeah. I met him when let's see, he was 15 and I was 14.
Uh-huh.
He was at Juilliard.
So did you take formal lessons from your aunt, or was it just that she was in your family and, you know, kind of led you in this musical, one of the people led you in this musical direction?
Yeah, I didn't study the viola, so I really didn't take any lessons from her until I was an adult, and I took a lesson on, I was preparing the Brahms violin concerto to play with an orchestra, and I asked her whether I could play for her, and she said, fine. And she had wonderful things to tell me about how to do that. Mm-hmm. I still remember exactly what she was telling me, and it was really helpful.
Mm-hmm. You know, Andy, when I first had the idea of interviewing you, I did a post at the Daily Music Break on Commander Cody. I didn't have any idea that if I did get a chance to interview you, Commander Cody would probably be maybe, a quarter of what we talked about. I mean, it's really remarkable. And it's been enjoyable. I appreciate it very, very much. And I wish you a great deal of success in the future. By the way, are you working on anything now to that people would be interested in hearing about?
Let's see. I just arranged Beethoven's Second Symphony for a chamber group that is modeled after a famous octet by Schubert.
Mm-hmm.
The chamber group, that octet, consists of a clarinet, a French horn, a bassoon, two violins, a viola, cello, and a string bass.
Mm-hmm.
And that arrangement that I made will be on a concert along with the Schubert octet for the same combination, performed by the St. Luke's Chamber Ensemble on October 19th at the Brooklyn Museum and October 22nd and 24th at the Morgan Library in Manhattan. And that's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to that.
Do they play it when they play in Brooklyn? Do they play in that that huge area on the ground floor where you have the balcony overlooking it in the rotunda there?
I doubt it. I don't know, but I think there's an actual concert hall in the Brooklyn Museum.
Oh, Brooklyn Museum is an amazing place. It really is.
Yeah, it really is. It's underestimated.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andy, I'd really like to thank you again very, very much. It's been fascinating, and you know, I just really appreciate it and wish you, as I said, I wish you continued success in everything you do in the future.
Well, thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Okay. Thank you, Andy. Take care.
Bye-bye.